Hap Siders, a coin dealer from Pennsylvania, was searching for his missing gold that he estimated was worth about $3 million. Law enforcement, meanwhile, was searching for Hap's wife. Rebahan Siders disappeared without a trace in 2012. Hap put out missing posters for his gold. Eventually, in 2020, 8 years after Rebahan vanished, 66-year-old Hap Siders stood trial for homicide. Rebahan's body hadn't been recovered. According to prosecutors, Hap had killed her after she had stolen his gold coins. But they were in for quite a challenge. Sandy Mason, a law professor at Penn Law School, explains why.
It's not typical for there to be no body. Most murder cases arise because there is a dead body. It's the rare case where the person has simply vanished and there's no concrete, immediate evidence that a death has occurred.
Hap's defense had a different version of events. They claim Rebahan stole her husband's coins and then deliberately disappeared, perhaps going overseas. And the jury, well, what would they think? This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 175. You're going to hear a story in this courtroom unlike anything you might ever have thought possible. Those are the words from Hap Siders' defense attorney as he spoke to the jury during opening statements in August 2020. Missing money, power, and control would be the themes that lay ahead as court proceedings began in a Cumberland County courtroom not far from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Representing the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Courtney Hare LaRue began her opening statements by describing the couple's whirlwind romance when they met in an Atlantic City casino and then quickly moved in together in Hap's house. Soon, everything unraveled. Quote, he controlled who she talked to, where she went, whether or not she worked, and how much money she was allowed to spend. He controlled her with violence and he controlled her with threats. But one day, Rebahan decided to try to take back some power by taking control over something that mattered to the defendant. And it was this struggle for power and control that ultimately cost Rebahan her life. The prosecutor went on. The defendant began to isolate Rebahan. He stopped her from working. He stopped her from having contact with friends and other family members. Police responded to the Siders' home on multiple occasions between 2008 and 2011. Their relationship was volatile. Sometimes the defendant would claim that Rebahan was the problem. He would claim that Rebahan chased him or tried to hurt him. But when police interviewed Rebahan, they saw a woman who was scared. The police, who have experience in dealing with domestic violence, saw the relationship for what it really was. They saw that Rebahan was in trouble, but she was trapped in the cycle of domestic violence, trapped by the power of control of this defendant, and she couldn't get out. The breaking point came in August 2011, when Rebahan's adult daughter witnessed Hap, who was her stepfather, hurting her mother. Hap was charged in that incident, and with him temporarily out of the house, Rebahan took action, as the prosecutor put it. She accessed a safe in the house where Hap stored his prized currency collection. Then she left. According to Prosecutor LaRue, she stole his currency and gold, quote, not to spend them, not to sell them, not to trade them, but to take something that mattered to this defendant, to take back some of the power and control in this relationship. And she took that power and control, and she stashed it away into a safe deposit box. She said for the next 6 months or so, Hap became more and more desperate as he searched for these coins. He tried searching for them on his own, then hired a private investigator. But she said soon it became clear that the only way to get his coins back was to regain control over Rabahan. And the only way to do that was to lure her back into a relationship. Prosecutor LaRue told the jury that Hap and Rabahan got back together. Rabahan moved back in. And slowly they started going on dates and taking trips together. But Rabahan kept her secret of where her husband's coins were. According to LaRue, it gave her a smidge of power over him. But she said Hap never forgot what he had lost. He was obsessive about it. He wrote journal entries noting what his wife was doing, where she was going, or who she was talking to. He couldn't stop thinking about his coins. March 27, 2012 was the last time 53-year-old Rabahan was seen alive. This was inside a drugstore as the couples did errands on a seemingly normal day. After March 27th, Rabahan's phone went dead. She didn't answer calls from her daughter. She stopped checking emails. Rabahan, a native of the former Soviet Union, didn't use her passport. Her bank account went untouched. She completely vanished, Prosecutor LaRue said. Or did she? Quote, what you will learn throughout this trial is that Rabahan did not vanish. She was murdered by this defendant, and her body was burned until there was nothing left but bones and ash. She was murdered because the defendant learned that he could never get her fully back under his power, and because he could not control her, he erased her. Prosecutor LaRue told the jury that they would be hearing from a lot of different witnesses, police officers and FBI agents, expert scientists and people from Rabahan's life. They're going to tell you that it was her daughter, not the defendant, not her husband, who reported her missing to the police on April 4th, 2012, she said. She also gave a preview of other evidence the Commonwealth would present, including Rabahan's DNA found on a knife, her bloodstains on the carpet and on a rug, strange smoke billowing out from the chimney that a neighbor saw, fragments of human bones found in the fireplace. She said the evidence only adds up to one conclusion, that while trying to regain power and control over Rabahan and his coins, Hap murdered Rabahan and then destroyed the evidence and any trace of the woman who could not be controlled. Then it was defense attorney George Matangos's turn. His account of Hap and Rabahan's beginnings of their relationship sounded similar at first to the prosecution's version. It was a whirlwind romance, he agreed. Rabahan was a masseuse in Atlantic City when she met Hap, and within days she moved into his Silver Spring Township home. She didn't even tell her daughter that she was moving, Matango said. She left her condo in Atlantic City, left her job. She lived a kept life. She drove a BMW. She and Hap bought a new condo in Atlantic City together. A beautiful place, Matango said. She had plenty of friends and had players' cards from 20 different casinos. Rabahan Hasanova found a mark with money, he told the jury. He called Hap a man of substance and said Rabahan robbed him of his gold bullions and gold coins he had collected and dealt. Then he said she lied about taking them. Quote, she lied under oath in front of a district judge, who is now a county judge here, about taking that property. Her daughter lied about it. They tried to keep it secret. Why would they do such a thing? Why not be honest? If it's about getting power back, why not be honest with the investigators, with the judge, especially when you're under oath to tell the truth? Matangos then answered his own rhetorical question. Rabahan lied because this wasn't about gaining power. She wanted money, he said. Hap was still going back and forth with his ex-wife, Denise, on their divorce settlement, which is why he said Rabahan and her daughter wanted to keep the gold bullion hidden and out of Denise's hands. Rabahan's daughter, Valeria, would be testifying later. And according to Matangos, She was a liar. Quote, after they interviewed Valeria, Rabahan's daughter, shortly after the alleged disappearance, she kept denying knowing anything about the money, no matter how hard. You're going to hear about this many hours long interview. She kept denying. No matter how hard the investigators tried to tell her, nothing you say is going to get you in trouble. They told her, listen, we're not looking, you know we understand, it was probably marital property. But he said the investigators were making legal conclusions there that weren't really true, that it wasn't marital property. It actually belonged to Hap and his ex-wife Denise. The jury didn't have to wonder for very long about the mystery of Hap's missing gold. Most of it was eventually found, Matangos told them. The stolen currency, 954 ounces of gold bullion, worth an estimated $3 million, was partially recovered. According to Matangos, the police recovered the money from the safe deposit boxes where Rabahan and her daughter had stored it in Philadelphia. He said they never told Hap nor his counsel that they had recovered it, but about $1 million worth was still missing. Matangos denied that Rabahan was a domestic violence victim or a woman in trouble. She was a woman who had a plan, he argued. He said she lied about the domestic abuse and that she set her husband up to get arrested and out of the house so she could steal the gold bullion. Matangos then dismissed the forensic evidence the prosecution said would be presented. The pieces of bones found in Hap's fireplace? Quote, we just heard from the government they are going to show you a whole body somehow was burned and the remains were found in the fireplace or the ash pit. What you are going to hear from those experts is that there is no DNA to match any of those items to Rabahan Siders. In fact, the expert is going to tell you they can't assure you, they cannot give you proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that they're even female bones. And I guarantee you're going to hear that they can't prove all of the bones came from one individual person. The knife in the bedroom with Rabahan's DNA on it? He said it was strange that it was still there. So why was the knife there, he asked. If that was the knife he used to kill her, why is it on the bedside table? And Rabahan's blood on the carpet sounded like convincing evidence at first glance. But he downplayed that too. Why is there only one drop of blood in the house, in a small one-foot area, square area of carpet that they found? Why is there no other evidence of this alleged, you know, killing and burning of a body, he asked. Matangos also poked at perhaps one of the biggest glaring weaknesses in the government's case against Hap Siders. No body. Maybe Rabahan, who the defense believed was plotting against her husband in a grand scheme, was still alive. Was she back in Kyrgyzstan? She had family who could help her slip back into her native land without detection, he suggested. She surely could live an extravagant lifestyle there with Hap's remaining stolen valuables. Quote, can I suggest to you that I know where Rabahan is right now? No. Can I suggest to you during the testimony that you're going to have a question or a reasonable doubt that she is, in fact, alive? Yes, I can suggest that because of the evidence. Or at least she was alive and Hap wasn't the one responsible for her death. He told the jury that they are about to hear a story unlike anything they might ever have thought possible. Silver Spring Township Police Sergeant Todd Lindsay responded to a domestic violence call at the Siders' home in 2008, before they were married. Rabahan claimed Hap jumped at her and scared her, so she ran and got a knife to defend herself. It was Hap who called 911 and said his wife was chasing him with a knife. According to Sergeant Lindsay, Rabahan told him it wasn't the first time Hap had tried to hurt her, and if anything ever happened to her, her friends would know Hap was responsible. No charges were filed. Authorities returned to the house on another call, this time in 2009. Officer Matthew Walters responded to the house. Happ and Rabahan, who was still his live-in girlfriend at that point, got into an argument. Officer Walters would testify at trial that Rabahan pulled a knife on him, that she said she pulled the knife out when Happ picked up a chair and threatened to throw it at her. Again, no charges were filed, although Officer Walters said Happ sent Rabahan a no trespass letter on the same day. 2 years later, on August 30th, 2011, Officer Joseph Craven responded to the home. It was another domestic violence call. When he arrived, Rabahan was distraught and crying. She said she had been sitting at the kitchen table eating with her husband when they got into an argument, either about finances or a woman who Rabahan was jealous of, depending on who you asked. The meal got messy. Somebody threw a bowl of soup. Officer Craven testified that Happ had stood above Rabahan and struck her over the head repeatedly with a closed fist. She had a large bump on the back of her head. In this incident, Happ was arrested and charged with simple assault and harassment. As Happ was being led away to the police car, another sergeant who had been talking with Rabahan came out of the house and asked Happ where Rabahan's ID and documents were. Happ had gone through her purse and taken her important documents. Happ said they were in his office. Then something seemed to happen to Happ out of nowhere. He gasped, went limp, and rolled his head back. He complained how thirsty he was. The officer gave him water and noticed the symptoms disappeared. Officer Craven testified that he thought Happ was exaggerating or pretending to need medical attention to evade arrest or get sympathy. Officer Craven then spoke privately with Rabahan. She showed him bruises on her legs. Under Happ's bail conditions, he wasn't allowed to be in contact with Rabahan or go to the house. And so with Happ gone, Rabahan's attention seemingly turned to something else. She needed assistance drilling one of Happ's safes to get access to what was inside. Now retired Silver Spring Township Police Detective Dale Sabadish, a veteran with 30 years in law enforcement, took the stand to describe two incidents involving Happ's missing money. The first incident was in the summer of 2009. When Happ contacted Detective Sabadish to report $100,000 worth of foreign coins missing from a safety deposit box. Happ had shared a box with Rabahan. At the time of the theft, Happ and Rabahan weren't married. They got married about 4 or 5 months after Happ reported the coins were gone. The theft case, however, never went anywhere. Then, in September 2011, Detective Sabadish again spoke to Happ after he came to the police station when he had been arrested for simple assault. Quote, he told me that he had been involved in a domestic situation with Rabahan, his current wife, and that he found out that a safe that was in the house had been accessed by somebody drilling it, and he claimed to me, or reported to me, that there were approximately $2 to $3 million worth of gold coins, currency removed from that safe. So he was basically reporting a theft of $2 to $3 million. The safe was registered to Rabahan, who had contacted a locksmith to open it. She said she forgot the combination and wanted to see if her social security and green card were inside. Happ seemed to know exactly what was missing. He had kept an inventory of his coins, and after they disappeared, he sent the list to auction houses to be on the lookout. The millions of dollars in coins never showed up. Once again, the theft case never resulted in criminal charges. The senior district attorney decided it was a domestic matter involving marital property. Emily Preventure was the Cumberland County community prosecutor who brought the 2011 simple assault case against Happ. She estimated that she has worked with hundreds of victims in criminal matters, maybe thousands. She lost count. She testified that none of them were like Rabahan. At first, she said Rabahan was meek, quiet, and sad when she first met with her in September 2011. But Rabahan was also determined. She wanted to testify against Hap and hold him accountable after that domestic violence incident where soup was thrown and she said Hap hit her. In Pennsylvania, domestic violence victims can get what's called protection from abuse orders if they feel threatened by their partners. Rabahan obtained one against Hap for the 2011 case. In that legal document, she detailed what had happened between them, but she also expanded and claimed that Hap had been abusive to her at other times throughout the course of their relationship. Preventure testified about what Rabahan wrote on the protection from abuse order. Quote, she says, during the course of the couple's four-year marriage, defendant has engaged in a course of conduct that put plaintiff in fear of bodily injury and gave her concerns for her safety. Defendant's actions include, but are not limited to, punching walls, threatening plaintiff's life, punching, kicking, pulling hair, restraining, choking, isolation, and name-calling. She said Rabahan mentioned another incident that happened a few weeks earlier, in July 2011. Quote, sometime in the evening on or around July 28th of 2011 at the couple's residence, defendant acted in a physically menacing manner, which resulted in plaintiff's reasonable fear of bodily injury. Defendant grabbed plaintiff's arm and bent it behind her head as he choked her, threatened her life, and told her he would dispose of her body in the river in many pieces. Rabahan signed her name on the protection from abuse order. Preventure testified that meek, sad version of Rabahan soon changed. Quote, the first instance that stands out in my mind was she came to my office to meet with me, and she started talking about wanting me to drop the charges, but she was very sweet about it. I remember that interaction very well. She explained why that interaction stood out so much. Quote, I remember she was in the victim service room. It was in this building on the second floor, and I walked in and the first thing I noticed was her perfume. The whole room, even before I saw her, the overwhelming smell of perfume. And then I saw her, and she was dressed. She was overdressed. She had this white, either shirt or dress on. It was almost very ethereal, and it was very flowy. And she looked like she was going to church or to a special occasion. And she came running up to me, and she embraced me almost like a family member would. And she was just, oh, hi, Emily. Like we were long-lost friends, and how are you? It's good to see you. And she was complimenting my appearance. And I just found the whole interaction to be extremely strange, because as a prosecutor, that's not an interaction that I think is appropriate or professional with the victim. You know, I certainly don't ever have any sort of physical contact with any victims in my cases, so at first I was just taken aback by how she was dressed and the interaction. And then she was very sweet, but she began talking about how she wanted her husband back and how she loved him. And how she would, basically, we were just talking about the charges, which is a normal conversation I have with victims. She was saying she didn't want to go forward with it. And I told her that I understood, but that I wasn't dropping the charges. And she kept saying, well, I love my husband and I really need him home because I need to massage him. She kept saying that over and over again, and I didn't understand. At that time, I had no idea why she was saying that to me. I thought it was a very strange statement to make. And I explained to her, you are a witness. You're going to have to appear for court again if we go to court. She left. She wasn't mad when she left, but I know that the purpose for her meeting with me that day was to get me to drop the charges, which I wasn't willing to do. The charges were serious, and Proventure wanted to move forward, even if Rabahan had suddenly changed her mind about wanting to prosecute. Still, Rabahan didn't let it go. She called Preventure multiple times a day, pleading for her to drop the charges against her husband. As soon as Preventure hung up the phone, Rebahan would call right back and the conversation would start all over again. The calls lasted for weeks, too many to count, Preventure said. Rebahan then complained to Preventure's boss about her handling of the case. I do not feel threatened at all. I love him deeply, Rebahan wrote in a letter. I would like to see my husband as soon as possible. I am lonely without him. Preventure refused to drop the case. While preparing for trial, she learned that Rebahan and Happ made a mediation agreement together. The agreement, which was notarized and signed November 2011, listed several requirements for the couple going forward. Happ promised to transfer $200,000 into Rebahan's bank account and transfer his house into both of their names, not just his. They would go to marriage counseling, and Rebahan would work to drop the bail restrictions against Happ. In December 2011, Happ pleaded guilty to simple assault in the exact same courtroom where he was now being tried for murder. Happ and Rebahan walked out together afterwards, and the restrictions against seeing her were lifted. Preventure later testified that she thought they looked happy as they left. Peter Russo was the Cumberland County attorney who prepared the mediation agreement between Happ and Rebahan in November 2011. He stated that Happ wanted to get the marriage back to where it was in the beginning, but that Rebahan had serious concerns about not being a part of the marriage, that she didn't know about financial assets. She wasn't a full partner, and that was a big concern to her, he said. The mediation went well. Everyone seemed to be in a good mood because Happ and Rebahan were working towards the same goal. Towards the end, Russo asked Happ to step outside the conference room for a moment so he could speak privately to Rebahan. He brought up the stolen currency from the drilled-out safe that had disappeared after the domestic violence incident in 2011. He warned Rebahan that Happ was hiring a private investigator to look for his coins. Eventually, the money will be found, he told her. Just be honest. Where is the gold currency and coins? He told her that if she's interested in having her marriage continue, she should just say it, and that she could say it confidentially. But Rebahan was adamant. Somebody else stole it. Then, according to Russo, she spoke calmly and matter-of-factly. Quote, she basically looks me dead cold in the eye and says, do you know who I am? Do you know what my background is? If I wanted to disappear, I would disappear and you would never find me again. So stop asking me questions about this gold. He said Rebahan continued and said if she disappeared, Happ would get blamed, that everyone would think she was dead. Happ's defense attorney asked Peter what he knew about Rebahan's family from all their time spent together in mediation. Quote, there was some discussion about the fact that her father was involved in the transportation or sale of weapons and ammunition to third parties, and actually referenced the Chinese government as well. I have nothing to substantiate that in terms of she didn't give me examples. I never met her father. It was just something she had said to me while we were talking about things. You know, about life at some point. Stephen Geringer was in the rare coin business, buying and selling them. It was a hobby that had turned into a profession after he started collecting them in the military. Coin dealers were rare. There were only 10,000 or so in the United States, he estimated in his testimony. They ran little coin shops and sold their products in the mail. Only about 1,000 were experts and doing big business, traveling around the country. Through coins, that's how Stephen met Happ in the late 1990s. They built up a strong business relationship. According to Geringer, Happ wasn't getting rich from his coin dealings. He was probably breaking even and doing it for a hobby, he said. At one point, Happ did $700,000 in sales. When the coins and gold were taken from the safe, Geringer was there to help Happ try to recover them. They turned to the dealer community to spread the news that the items were missing. There were no serial numbers for gold bullions, making them impossible to trace. But there were serial numbers for the national notes, which is what banks issued as their own money in the late 1800s up through 1929. Geringer said they put in a lot of effort to find the money and went to major coin shows to look. But their efforts were in vain. They turned up empty-handed. Hap Siders had told law enforcement that he dropped Rabahan off in Atlantic City at a casino on March 28, 2012. Rabahan was missing from that point forward, and Special Agent Eric Rardian was the primary investigator from the FBI's Philadelphia division. He testified that since she had gone across state lines and was dropped off in Atlantic City, it would be a federal violation if she was murdered. Hence why the FBI was brought in to assist. Agent Rardian established that, sure enough, Hap's BMW traveled from Harrisburg to Atlantic City on the toll road and back to Harrisburg on March 28th. He pulled off the Atlantic City Turnpike at 5:45 p.m. and then pulled back onto the toll road 23 minutes later, which gave authorities a timeline to work with. They pulled security footage from the front entrance of the hotel and casino. Agent Rardian then watched the security video multiple times. He asked colleagues to watch it too. But nobody could see anyone who matched Hap's stature or description. There was also no sign of Rabahan. No BMWs pulling up either. It was mostly taxis. The FBI would end up not filing charges in the case. After investigating, the federal government couldn't determine if a federal crime had occurred after all. But Agent Rardian did find something significant. In May 2012, he came across hundreds of Hap's missing coins. He testified how authorities got subpoenas to multiple financial institutions, which had made them aware of the existence of four safe deposit boxes opened at banks in Philadelphia and Atlantic City. Agent Rardian then obtained a search warrant to open them. The keys didn't work on all of them, so they had to drill some of them open. And there were Hap's missing coins in safety deposit boxes 48 and 703. Both had been taken out under Valeria's name, Rabahan's daughter. The last time anyone accessed the boxes was September 2, 2011. Valeria Kolbova Vankashina, Rabahan's 31-year-old daughter, was called in as a witness at her stepfather's trial. Valeria currently lived in Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. Previously, she had lived in the United States. She had traveled to America at age 15 to live with her mother in New Jersey. The mother-daughter pair were close and often went shopping together and ate out at restaurants. Valeria was around 18 years old when her mom met Hap Siders. "I remember she was very happy. I saw her falling in love," Valeria testified. Valeria lived in an apartment in Philadelphia while her mom moved in with Hap. But things soon escalated. When Valeria went to visit her mom, she noticed them arguing about money. She said Rabahan was in trouble if she bought new $50 shoes. Rabahan wasn't working, but she ran the household and did all the chores. Hap controlled their finances, which on the stand, Valeria said she now realized was financial abuse. Valeria witnessed the aftermath of the couple's domestic violence incident in 2011. She said, quote, "I saw my mom laying on the floor unconscious and Hap over her with closed fists. She had a huge bump on her head." Valeria was also inside the home when the locksmith arrived at the house later on. Inside the safe were coins. Lots of them. "And you made a comment previously that it was items that your mom felt belonged to her because of what had happened to her?" the prosecutor asked Valeria on the stand. "Not only that, I have to add that she told me that it was in her name, the safe. She purchased it. And she told me that they had a business together, so she believed it belonged to her, that property, Valeria said. Rappahan was moving out of the house at that point. She and Hap's relationship was beyond repair, or so she thought. Valeria helped her mom move out and take the furniture to storage. Rappahan unloaded the gold and the coins out of the safe and stuffed them into suitcases. They were too heavy to carry. The defense alluded to 80 pounds of gold. Valeria testified that Rappahan asked her to open a security deposit box in Philadelphia to keep the coins safe. Valeria obeyed. She said she didn't believe Rappahan ever went to the bank to access the deposit box. Meanwhile, taking the coins didn't end things with Hap. Rappahan still snuck out to see him. She ignored the protection order. Their breakup was short-lived, which made Valeria angry. All I can describe about their relationship, they couldn't live without each other, but they couldn't live with each other, she said. Rappahan and Hap got back together. Unfortunately, Valeria testified. The prosecutor asked her, "You weren't happy with them getting back together?" "I was afraid she was going to be murdered in that relationship," Valeria told the court. She said she knew something was wrong when her mom disappeared. Valeria called her over and over again for 3 days. She left messages for Hap, too, who finally called her back from a number she didn't recognize. Quote, "He called me from a different number that I didn't know. He said, just in a normal voice, 'Oh, hi, Valeria.' I said, 'How are you?' He said, 'I'm fine.' And I said, 'Oh, can I get a hold of my mother? How is she? Where is she?' And he said, 'She's missing.' And I started to scream, like, 'What do you mean, missing? She's missing.' And I said, 'Did you do something to her? Did you have a fight again?' And I remember his voice just broke. And I said, 'Did you report her? Did you call the police?' He said, 'No.'" And so Valeria was the one who called authorities on April 4th, 2012. Rappahan hadn't been seen in about a week at that point. Investigators later obtained a search warrant for Hap's house and found Rappahan's jewelry, 4 rings and a pair of earrings that she never took off anywhere, not even in the swimming pool or in the shower. "I just knew," Valeria said. "If those rings were off, she's not alive. She would not take them off voluntarily." Police sent the jewelry to the lab, but no latent prints or other evidence was found. Sergeant David Jenkins, a 16-year veteran on the Silver Spring Township Police Force, was assigned to the missing persons case on April 6, 2012. Wondering if Rappahan's husband would know where she was, he called Hap. Hap declined to speak with him and referred him to his attorney, George Matangos, the same defense attorney who represented him at the murder trial. Matangos told Sergeant Jenkins that Rappahan was missing in Atlantic City, not in Silver Spring Township. He made a comment about Rappahan running off with Hap's money. And after that, he said Hap had no additional comments to make to police. Sergeant Jenkins obtained a sealed search warrant for Hap's home. It was Sergeant Jenkins's case, although the FBI and other law enforcement agencies assisted. On April 13, 2012, the search began. The prosecutor asked Sergeant Jenkins how Hap reacted when he was told police would be searching his property. "He didn't really say anything," Sergeant Jenkins testified. The sergeant's testimony made it seem like the Siders had an unusual home. He observed knives everywhere. Knives in the door pockets of Rappahan's BMW SUV, in the bathroom and the bedroom. He also saw 4 safes, including the one that had been drilled open earlier. Silver Spring Township Police started collecting evidence, including a rug in the master bedroom that looked to be stained with blood. Sergeant Jenkins testified that 2 of the stains on the rug were about the size of a basketball, 1 stain the size of 2 grapefruits side by side, and 1/4 was smaller than the others. Underneath the rug was carpet. The sergeant testified about seeing a circle on the carpet. It also looked like blood, so they collected samples to take back to the lab. another major source of evidence, the fireplace in the great room. While Sergeant Jenkins testified, the jury looked at photographs of the fireplace and the contents inside. Visible was debris and ash. The fireplace had what was referred to as a cleanup or a pit underneath it. By the fireplace was a U.S. postal box containing ash and debris that had been cleaned out of the fireplace. The box was full. Authorities suspected there were skeletal remains inside the box. The fragments of whatever it was were taken for additional testing. Under questioning by the defense, Sergeant Jenkins was asked about his April 19, 2012 interview with Rabahan's daughter, Valeria. Sergeant Jenkins and an FBI agent interviewed her and confronted her about the drilled-out safe and Hap's missing currency. It was an intense 2.5-hour interview. They accused Valeria of being a liar. The FBI agent told her she had no job and no ambition. Valeria got angry and called him rude. But Valeria held firm. She wouldn't admit to knowing anything about the safe's missing contents and would not say if her mom had taken the coins and the 80 pounds of gold. She also didn't mention that she had taken out a security deposit box in her own name to hide Hap's coins. "We tried our best to get the whole truth out of her during the interview," Sergeant Jenkins testified. The defense pointed out that they kept telling Valeria that they didn't care if she did something with the money. They just wanted to know the truth. "Is that fair to say that that was the general tone of both you and Agent Rardian?" Matangos asked. "Yes," Sergeant Jenkins agreed. Facing cross-examination from the defense at her stepfather's homicide trial, Valeria admitted she lied in her prior interviews with law enforcement. She also confessed that she had taken the coins and put them in a security deposit box at a bank in Philadelphia. She said her mom had asked her not to tell anyone about the coins and the safe. In a rather explosive exchange, Matango said, "And the question then is you repeatedly, over and over again, all the way through the end of the interview, still denied knowing anything about gold coins, about money taken from the safe. Why did you keep denying that when you know it's true?" "My mother, she told me not to tell anyone," Valeria said. "So you did know?" Matangos asked. "Yes." "And you just kept lying to them over and over and over again?" Matangos asked. "Yes," Valeria said. She agreed that her mom had asked her to open the safe deposit boxes. She said they had a joint account, but that her mom told her it was better to put them in her name. "It was put in your name, but she had access to it?" Matangos asked. "Yes, I never had any access to it. I never wanted to have access to it," Valeria said. She reiterated that her mom believed she was entitled to the coins. Valeria acknowledged that investigators made her feel uncomfortable and that she was concerned about being named a theft suspect and about lying to them. That's why she signed an agreement to talk off the record with the district attorney as authorities were getting ready to present their murder case against Hap to a grand jury. Under cross-examination, Valeria admitted she didn't work back then and earned $0 in income. Her mom, who also didn't work, paid for Valeria's expensive Philadelphia apartments. Valeria said she invested in fashion, buying designer bags and clothing, again with her mom's money. Let's be frank about it. During the period she was with Hap, Hap was her source of income, so Hap paid for those things, did he not? Matango said. They pointed out that Valeria was even becoming rich. They said she received over $100,000 in two checks and cash worth $30,000 to $40,000, all given to her by her mom. Valeria said she never asked where the money came from. She was just thankful for it. At the time of the trial, Valeria was living back in her native country, Kyrgyzstan. When asked about her occupation, she said she organized music events, gave lectures on music for charity, and created her own kombucha brewing company. "Did you take the money with you back to Kyrgyzstan? The money from your accounts you had in America? Or do you still have open accounts in America? The defense asked. She said she still had open accounts. The judge would not allow the defense to ask how much was still left in those accounts after the prosecution objected that it wasn't relevant. The judge agreed, saying that wasn't the actual issue at trial. Only one house stood between Jody Hocker's house and the Siders. Jody could see the Siders' house from the bay window in her living room. And one day in 2012, she saw smoke coming out from the Siders' chimney. Quote, "The whole 15 years I lived there, I had never seen anything coming from the chimney. So it was odd and the smoke was not normal. It was dark smoke, thick smoke. Normally from a chimney, it would be light, white kind of smoke." Jody testified that she would know what normal smoke looked like. She had a fireplace herself and also grew up on a farm where her family used a wood-burning stove as their main heat source. The testimony was another piece of circumstantial evidence, perhaps one more step in a long path if the jury was going to convict.
What we typically call circumstantial evidence requires a chain of inferences to get to the conclusion the prosecution's trying to prove. So if you have evidence, I think the newspaper article in this case mentioned that for days after her disappearance, the blinds of the house where they lived were closed and there was black smoke rising from the chimney. Okay. Is that evidence that he killed her? It requires a chain of inferences. The inference that something unusual is happening. The blinds aren't typically closed in the house. If something unusual is happening, that makes it more likely that something unusual has happened to break the routine of their daily life. The blinds are closed, you can infer, because he didn't want anyone to see what was happening inside the house. Why didn't he want anyone to see what was happening inside the house? Maybe because he was dismembering a body and burning it in the fireplace. You know, why is there black smoke rising from the chimney? Maybe for the same reason. But that is a chain of logical inferences that's fairly attenuated. Now, anytime you ask jurors to make an inference, there is potentially room for doubt.
The FBI analyzed the bone pieces that had been pulled out from the ash pit and the Siders' fireplace in their living room. 18 bones were identified, according to the prosecution. Dr. Angie Christensen is an FBI forensic anthropologist who studies human bones. She looked at the bones in this case under a microscope. Her findings were mixed. Some of the bone fragments were indeed from a human. A hand bone and a lower arm bone, along with an upper right jaw. She listed off the bones and colored them in with a red Sharpie on an outline of a human body to show the jury. Although some of what she was looking at were indeed bones, including pieces of a vertebrae, a rib, and a lung bone, she could not conclusively say if they were human or not, because the fragments were too small. She was looking at a fragment of a rib bone, but was it human? Or could it belong to a chicken, which shared some of the same bones in its skeleton? Under cross-examination, she said, "So conservatively, I said that they could potentially be. They are consistent with human, but I couldn't say for certain. Other animals have those bones." Also hailing from Quantico, Virginia, was Lara Adams, a forensic examiner at the FBI laboratory. She testified that she received 4 bones or fragments of bones believed to be human to test and look for DNA. She couldn't produce any results. No luck. No, as she put it, quantifiable DNA could be pulled, since none of the bones were in good shape. They looked like they were very extensively burned. And we know that when DNA is subjected to heat, it breaks. It breaks down. It breaks apart. It cuts the strands of DNA, she said on the stand. It was unusual for the forensic examiner, who had worked on 40 to 50 cases before. She recalled only one other time when she hadn't been able to generate a mitochondrial DNA profile from bone tissue. Morse was a cadaver dog who used his nose to sniff out human blood and human decomposition. Martin Grime, a canine trainer from England, was working as an FBI contractor. He had been called in 2012 to assist with the investigation. To a dog, decomposition is a very pungent odor, and it is very persistent, Grime testified. Grime went in blind with the dogs. He wasn't sure what he was looking for and didn't know much about the alleged crime. He brought Morse, an English Springer Spaniel victim recovery dog, and Morse's older sister, Keela, to the Siders house. Keela, the other dog, was trained to freeze and point when she caught the scent of human blood, her specialty. She was very, very accurate, Grime testified. The only item in the house and on the property that had caught Keela's attention was inside a bedside cabinet drawer on the second floor master bedroom. It was a stainless steel knife. Grime testified that in the basement, Morse was sniffing and non-specific barking in the center of the room. That meant, based on his training, that Morse smelled human decomposition, but couldn't identify the exact source of where it was coming from. Quote, so then we conducted a bit of a more thoroughfare to the basement, and the dog responded to a full-size axe propped against the wall. The half bathroom on the first floor also got a reaction from Morse. He alerted on the bathtub. Other human decomposition alerts were on the second floor, in a room containing a large safe. A wool ski mask exposed beneath the safe set off an alert. So did a plumbing access panel in that room, which had an exposed pipe that led into the half bathroom. Another hit was in the second floor master bedroom, again by a bathtub which had an exposed access panel and exposed pipes leading to the master bathroom. Grime testified that, quote, the dog will alert to anything that has gone through the pipe or even through the conduit that the pipes are in. So if, for example, there's a body in the bath, then the odor would be, it would migrate through the conduit, and we can expect the dogs to locate and respond to that. The knife that Keela the dog responded to was collected as evidence and tested. There was a stain on the knife, although investigators weren't able to definitively learn what exactly caused the stain. Was it blood? They couldn't be 100% sure. Charity Davis, an FBI nuclear DNA examiner, tested the stain on the knife and testified that the stain was too faint, so it couldn't be confirmed definitively as blood, although it was indeed possible that it was. What could be confirmed was whose DNA was on the stain. It was a mix of male and female DNA, two individuals. Rabahan Siders was the major contributor. The other could not be determined. Rabahan's blood was found elsewhere in the house, too. She was the source of the DNA on the bloodstains, on the carpet and rug. Hap Siders didn't take the stand to testify in his defense, but the jury still got to hear some of his words and thoughts. Sergeant Jenkins read some of Hap's journal entries that had been taken into evidence. One entry said, quote, on 325 or 326, we came to Mechanicsburg. It's funny, I don't recall which day. We both did some yard work and she cooked dinner. Everything seemed wonderful. Over the last few days, I had asked several times about the coins, and she said very little. I tried to impress upon her that we needed them to live because money would run out in a couple years. Ryan Parthamore, a forensic expert who now works in the Cumberland County District Attorney's Office, testified about documents recovered inside Hap's Dell laptop. He read them out loud to the jury. One said, quote, I don't know if she has the coins and certainly want to pursue every lead possible. If we find the whereabouts of the contents without her help or with her help, that is still the goal. Hap wrote in another, quote, I am very serious about recovering the contents for the drilled safe. In the meantime, I have given $200,000 and half of the house to maintain dialogue. However, I see half of the house as being to my advantage. The PFA has been dropped. She has returned the house contents that she removed to storage. She also returned a few coins, which were in her bank safe deposit box. After that, the testimony was over. All of the witnesses had been called, and now it was time for closing arguments. Defense attorney George Matangos said this, quote, "Number one, what crime has been committed? Have they proven to you that Rabahan Siders is dead? There's no actual proof that Rabahan Siders is dead. You cannot take evidence that is incredible, unbelievable, contradictory, or on its face makes no sense in the big picture." He pointed out that to dismember and burn a body is messy, gruesome, and blood would be flying everywhere. Yet only a small amount of blood was found on the carpet, something he said he gets on the floor from clipping his toenails. He also pointed out that the cadaver dogs didn't get a hit on the fireplace. The bones found in the fireplace couldn't be identified as a man or woman's and couldn't be conclusively ruled as Rabahan's remains, he said. He was also dismissive that the fireplace could be hot enough to incinerate a human body. The prosecution didn't prove it was possible, he argued. "Do not allow the government to blow smoke," he quipped. He argued that investigators hadn't done anything to search for Rabahan in other countries, where she could be presumably living a wealthy lifestyle with the money she stole from her husband. If Rabahan dies, her secret of where she put Hap's valuables dies with her. Hap would never get it back, so there was no motive for Hap to kill her, he argued. As for Valeria's testimony, he said the jury shouldn't trust her. She wasn't a credible witness and had lied to authorities before. In her closing arguments, prosecutor Courtney Hare LaRue reminded the jury about the 18 bones found in the fireplace and what she called the house of death. Quote, "The only trace of Rabahan that is left is those human bones. The defendant had motive. He had the means and he had the opportunity. And he was the only one with motive, according to him. Millions of dollars of motive and months of pent-up anger and desperation to find that money. Hap made missing posters for his currency, not for his wife," she said. "And his stepdaughter called to report Rabahan missing, not him. You saw the defendant's notes and his diary entries where he talked about tracking her phone calls, documenting who she talked to, how long they were on the phone, how many times she called that number. He tracked her EasyPass records. He tracked the GPS data from their vehicle. He tracked where she was going, who she was meeting with. And you even heard from his own diary that sometimes he would follow the GPS in his car and go check out what was actually at that address. Rabahan was living under a microscope. She was under total surveillance by this defendant. And attorney Matangos tries to tell you that she ran away? Seriously? He's tracking her every move and she just vanishes into thin air? This is not a woman who could just run away," she argued. She admitted that she didn't know exactly how Rabahan was murdered. "Judge Brubaker is going to instruct you, and she's going to tell you that we don't need to know, that you don't need to know exactly what happened to render a verdict in this case and find the defendant guilty." The jury deliberated for about 2 hours. Their verdict? Not guilty. Hap Siders was acquitted and was ordered released immediately. Afterwards, Hap's attorney, George Matangos, spoke to the Patriot News. "Justice eventually does prevail," he said. Hap was too tearful to say anything. He can't believe people understood what he's been through. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this case. Do you agree with the verdict? Or do you think there was enough evidence presented to convict? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. And a special thank you to Sandy Mason, a law professor at Penn Law School, for giving us her thoughts on prosecuting murder cases without a body. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads and hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. And be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.